Hi everyone, I'm Connor McCafferty and this is The Infinite City, stories from Belfast of people and place. For our special summer season of The Infinite City this July, we're speaking with professionals whose careers have intersected with the city of Belfast and with the work of place. In the archive already, you can check out conversations with Aisling O'Byrne, Garrett Carr, Agustina Martire, Darren Anderson, and Barry Todd. Today, our guest is a place alumnus, someone whose career has brought together a passion for cycling with the discipline of urban design and smart city technologies. Aaron Coulter is an urban designer from Belfast. With a degree in environmental planning, he went on to pursue a master's in urban and rural design, both at Queen's University. As a graduate, Aaron worked with both Place and the Forum for Alternative Belfast on various urbanist initiatives in the city. After working for several years as an urban designer in London, Aaron recently took up post as the Smart Cities Programme Manager at Seasense, a cycling technology and data company based in Northern Ireland. Aaron himself is based mostly in London these days. I caught up with him on Skype to talk about cycling in Belfast compared to other cities and how to improve the cycling experience through urban design and data. I really enjoyed catching up with Aaron and nerding out a bit about cycling in the city. To begin, I asked Aaron about his early memories of Belfast, the city where he grew up. Aaron Coulter, you're very welcome to the Infinite City podcast.
Thanks very much. Good to be here. Early memories of the city, running around, getting lost in various different places, I think it defines my youth. I think introduction to the bicycle. Well, when I was about a teenager, so maybe like 14, 15, me and my mates used to start going out, kind of almost escaping the city in a way, we lived in East Belfast and pretty easy access into the Craigannet Hills and down the Ards Peninsula. It was those kind of experiences which formed my interest, which I rediscovered in the last couple of years in terms of cycling and what that can do for a city. Mm. Belfast back then... it was a really fun place to grow up, and I think I kind of contrast that with now I live in London, and people are always asking, what was Belfast like growing up as a kid? and for us, it was a completely normal experience. Yeah, it was a good experience. Normal childhood.
So you're an urban designer by profession. Can you describe what urban design involves for someone who doesn't know much about it?
The way I kind of place it, which tends to annoy other professions that I benchmark it against, but it sits somewhere between architecture and kind of traditional town planning. Mm-hmm. So architecture for me is the kind of design and creation of buildings specifically, in more often than not in isolation. Town planning sets kind of the policy and legislative framework in which that single building can be created, and urban design tries to find this kind of sweet point between the two that mm-hmm. says, okay, well, let's look at an area in context and try to design some principles around what should get built and where, and trying to almost visualize what the legislative framework that the planning system is articulating. Give that some kind of visual meaning and form. So yeah, that's kind of what I've been working at for the last 7 or 8 years as an urban designer.
Mm. It's probably not really a career path that most people would be familiar with, you know, at school age, for example. So what attracted you to the field, or how did you first kind of encounter it?
When I was in school, no, I didn't think when I grew up I wanted to be an urban designer. In truth, I had no idea what I wanted to be when I was at school.
Yeah. Lots of us have been there, yeah.
Yeah. Pretty much exactly that. Yeah, I think back at school I was just about maintaining the grades to stay in school and keep playing hockey, because that's all I really cared about then. And I didn't really start taking things seriously academically until what, A-level time, and probably even a bit later, if you ask my tutors at uni. but my mum and dad, for me, like, they have a very nice kind of hands-off approach and basically let me find my way. And my dad's advice was always just stick to what you're good at. And for me in school, that was mostly like history and geography were kind of like my go-to subjects. And I really loved that kind of understanding of places, understanding of people. That's really kind of what piqued my interest when I was at school. And yeah, following that advice of sticking to what you're good at, whether it's good advice or not, I'm not too sure, but it's got me to where I am now. I went along to an open day at Queen's to the environmental planning course. And it's Geraint Ellis, who's still there now, I think he's professor now, was giving a talk that just really kind of captured my attention compared to all the other stuff that I was going and looking at. And from then going through the undergrad environmental planning course, and every semester there was always a design component or design module. And those tended to be the ones that I, relatively speaking, like, excelled at. I was kind of thinking, okay, stick to what you're good at, keep going. And that kind of, led me down the path of doing in the urban and rural design masters at Queen's as well. Yeah.
That's interesting. That's kind of history and geography, in a way, were really what kind of propelled you towards it. It's because, I mean, I can obviously, there's the obvious kind of understanding of geography would be so key, but tell us a bit more about why history would be an important component in urban design.
I think the people that know me will laugh because I'm always banging on about context and the importance of context when making decisions, just like normal business decisions. Context is really important, and context in urban design is vital. And that just isn't solely about, you know, what building is next door and what are the land uses and all of these things. But it's really about how have the decisions that have influenced what those land uses are, how have they taken shape over the last number of years. Really trying to get a holistic understanding of place. Like, history is so vital, a component of that. And even now with, I'm sure we'll get onto it, but even now with some of the work that we're doing at C-Sense, it is this kind of appreciation of kind of the spatial understanding of the city and how that's actually formed over the years really will have an influence on the things that you're seeing in the city today. So I think it's just being able to kind of step back and piece together this kind of narrative of space and place.
Where in the world are urban designers most in demand at the moment, would you say?
Demand's a tricky one. I wish we were really in demand. So I moved to London basically to get a job in urban design in 2012. And I've basically just been working on new build residential schemes, a few inner city schemes as well, but everywhere in the UK, there's big demand for more houses. There's a housing crisis. So that's kind of what's driving the urban design profession at the minute in the UK context. Elsewhere, then obviously, you know, you've got new cities popping up left, right and center in Asia. And I think there's a demand there as well, but completely different context to kind of like what I've been doing, really.
And speaking of context then as well, I mean, so you have obviously personal experience and some working experience in Belfast, and then more kind of working experience and kind of living more recently in London. So how does the kind of context differ for an urban designer between those two cities in particular?
So in Belfast, obviously, as you know, I was doing a bit of work with Place back in the day, as well as Forum for Alternative Belfast. I was part of the design lab there. And I have to say that the work that I did in Belfast was undoubtedly probably some of the most rewarding work that I did. And that was what, within the first kind of 6 months of my kind of early career. I think Belfast as a city is an amazing place to work and try to understand. And I always kind of bang on about what an interesting city it is for all the things that have kind of helped form it into the city it is now. So whenever you're talking about context and interest, Belfast is like by far and away the most interesting place I've ever actually been able to undertake some work. When I compare that to the work that I've been doing in London, it's a lot more kind of commercially focused, which has its pros and its cons. So yeah, I kind of know the planning system like the back of my hand now, and actually, you know, have a far better appreciation of why decisions are made within local authorities, or even more importantly, why decisions aren't made within local authorities, and have a far better understanding of, you know, how to engage with different stakeholders, whether they be in the public or private sector. And I think all of that's been really vital kind of like understanding, but really where I'd like to get back to at some stage in my career is, yeah, working back in Belfast. I think that would be a nice kind of full circle for me.
It's really positive to hear that as well, because I mean, as you said yourself, you kind of felt you had to go for the experience to London, and I think a great many young people who maybe come from here, or you know, come from other parts of Northern Ireland, for example, to study in Belfast or other parts of Ireland and study here, and then feel there aren't the opportunities here that can kind of propel their career in a way. So it's great to hear that actually, you know, your ambition in some ways is also to kind of contribute to Belfast.
Yeah, for sure. I was listening back to the podcast with Barry Todd. Yeah, so like long time listener, first time caller. But and he had mentioned, you know, architecture being the barometer of the building industry. And I think particularly, so I left my master's in 2011. Job market was terrible at that stage for grads, you know, and particularly in planning, urban design, it was virtually non-existent. You know, I was applying for job, like graduate jobs in Hong Kong.
And would you have gone, do you think?
Probably, yeah. Like if you think about it at that stage, I think it was almost just like desperation. I think, okay, these are the jobs that are going. I'm just going to have to like kind of get up and go here. Moving to London was probably a nice compromise between that.
A curious thing about built environment professions here, and I don't know if it's like a Northern Ireland thing or UK and Ireland more broadly or what it is, but there seems to be a kind of separation, or maybe even a kind of a like a hierarchy, where architecture, planning, urban design, you know, landscape architecture, etc. There's all these related disciplines that people work in, but they're kind of seen as separate. But that's perhaps not the case in other parts of Europe, for example, where it's more common to have architect planners, you know, who kind of they're trained to work in both kind of simultaneously. So what's your perspective on that kind of separation?
I think the boundaries are beginning to blur slightly. I've been fortunate enough, so kind of worked at two companies, one which was a landscape architecture led firm, which also had urban designers and architects. So landscape architecture was the kind of the primary profession there. But again, everyone kind of pitched into everyone else's projects, and we all kind of collectively worked together to create something. And as well as that, I've been working at quite a large or relatively large multidisciplinary firm, which brought in even, you know, engineers, planners, architects, urban designers. And you'd create this kind of multidisciplinary team of people working on a specific project. And I think it's that kind of approach which is probably the most appropriate, because I don't think you can be, you know, jack of all trades and, and know everything about everything. There does need to be some kind of specificity to what you know and how you apply that. But I think it's that kind of thing of, well, don't stick in your silo. Like, you know, if urban designers just talk to urban designers about urban design, like you wouldn't progress very far, or you wouldn't come up with like a really holistic solution. And you know, that is kind of part and parcel of what urban design is. We often find ourselves actually, you know, project managing and leading a project which would bring in other professions, and it was kind of our job to kind of synthesize all the different ideas and to create this one kind of vision, I guess, for a future place.
So Aaron, we first crossed paths back in, would have been 2012 at Place, and one of the things you worked on then was a super interesting kind of series of articles for the Place blog, which was called Connecting Places Bicycling Belfast. So do you remember doing that? And can you tell us what you were trying to do with that series?
So it was kind of obviously rereading some of that a good few years later. Some of it's slightly cringe inducing, but actually, by and large, I'm still actually pretty comfortable with what I put down in writing there. So yeah, it was good. It kind of goes back to basically being a fan of this is like the most uncool thing you can admit to working in, you know, the kind of bicycle advocacy space. But yeah. I'm a huge fan of the sport of cycling. Mm-hmm. Massive. So yeah, when I was like 14, 15, I'd be, you know, spending my summer watching the Tour de France and going off pretending I was Lance Armstrong in the Craigantlet Hills, but without the drugs. So the full on kind of like a loser, which contrasts completely with my kind of approach to cycling in urban areas. So I grew up as a teenager. Cycling was a sport, and that's kind of wholly what it was remained for years. And that kind of perception only really changed whenever I went to Stockholm. So I studied in Stockholm for a semester or two. Mm-hmm. I was part of like the Erasmus exchange program. And it was there that I noticed that, you know, people my age were kind of cycling to get around the city. And for me, that was completely alien. In those days, you didn't see barely anyone, you know, cycling the University of Queen's. It definitely wasn't on my radar, even as like, you know, an environmental planning student. it just wasn't on my radar as something, as the done thing. So went to Stockholm and saw that, this kind of actually works in the city. Yeah, me and my friends, we were cycling around, but came back to Belfast and was like, oh, this is kind of what is missing from the city.
In Stockholm, was it like, what was it that you noticed? Is it just the sheer number of people cycling, or was it the infrastructure? Were you aware of that at the time, or what kinds of things did you notice?
I guess my first memory of cycling in Stockholm was stepping out of one of the tunnel banner, the subways, stepping out, you know, complete tourist mode, looking up in the sky, and all I hear is all these like bike bells ringing at me, and I was like stood in the middle of the bike lane. I think that was my first realization that, oh right, cycling here is a thing, and there's actually there's space for it. And then beyond that, it was just a case of, okay, getting on a bike and realizing how much more convenient it was to get from A to B, and the kind of freedom that offered you in a city space, which was, something that when we came back to Belfast, it was like, oh, this is what's missing potentially. So whenever I came back, I think I was the start of my urban design master's. I picked myself up an old bike from Gumtree and started, just trying to see, is like, okay, does this work in the context of Belfast? You know, going to uni, getting to work, going to see my mates. So I was just trying to see, like, okay, can I use this as a tool to like get about and do my kind of day-to-day things? And what I found, and it's like super cliche to say, but like it was almost this complete total freedom of the city in a way. Like I was no longer confined to waiting on the 3A bus to get into the city center, which, you know, would be like once every 20, 25 minutes if you're lucky. I was no longer stuck in the traffic outside Colmswater. You know, I was kind of basically flying past it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because of some, you know, like mad environmental crusade, although, you know, obviously that's a key benefit. But it was probably driven by my own laziness. You know, I could lie in longer. It took me less time to get to work. It saved me money. It was these kind of things. And yes, it was kind of, it was good fun as well.
All the things you mentioned there are kind of all the benefits of cycling in the city. Were there any things that you noticed when you first started cycling in Belfast that you felt, you know, oh my God, this just is not working?
I had a bit of a run-in with a car at one stage in the city centre, which was the classic, sorry, mate, didn't see you in the broad daylight kind of thing. It wasn't as inviting a space as, you know, the actual cycle infrastructure in Stockholm and things. It was kind of like, I was fortunate enough that, I grew up cycling, so I was confident cyclist even at that stage. I knew how to cycle in traffic, but certainly if it wasn't for that kind of background of, you know, the sport of cycling, would me hopping on a bike at 24 happen? Probably not. The city wasn't maybe as well as equipped as it could have been to facilitate that.
And then I think you kind of went into some detail on that then in the series that you wrote. So what were some of the things that you sort of found about cycling in the city, and what were the kind of things that you suggested or put forward to improve cycling?
So I realized this went off on a complete tangent there. That was the context for how then this series kind of formulated. It's all these things that I've been kind of like thinking about. It's like, okay, well, why doesn't this feel as good as it could? Then being able to use the kind of skills that I'd learned through like my environmental planning course and urban design course to try and like actually question and critique that. The first part was talking about, you know, debunking the myth that cycling can't be a thing in Belfast, you know, just urban everyday cycling can't be a thing. The DRD in the Belfast Metropolitan Transport Plan 2004 said, as a result of varying levels of congestion, topography and land use, a blanket citywide approach to providing a cycling network is unlikely to be appropriate in Belfast. For me, that was just like completely no vision, a statement which was completely at odds with itself. Like, you know, saying, we're really congested here, so now there's no space for bikes. It was a completely backwards way of kind of viewing it. And it was like things like that. Like once I started actually looking into it more, I was thinking we probably actually need to be starting to create a bit more of discussion around this and the role of cycling in the city.
And I think one of the things as well that you kind of advocate for in the series is the idea of like modal share. So maybe you could describe that term and whether that term still sort of is an important one to consider these days.
Yeah, so modal share is basically if you took 100 people all cycling, or well, I wish, if you took 100 people all getting to work and, you know, 20 of those chose to cycle, that would mean that of those people, there's 20% modal share for cycling. Mm-hmm. So it's basically the breakdown of how people get to and from work or kind of move around the city. As I found, every city calculates it slightly differently, but that's the general kind of principle behind it. It's a useful kind of barometer to see what modes of transport are predominantly used in a city. So at that stage, I think we were looking at Belfast and it was maybe like a 2% for cycling, and contrasting that to the big hitters in the world of urban cycling, you know, like Amsterdam and Copenhagen, which are seeing kind of like from like 30 to 50% modal share for cycling, which is huge. Those are the kind of barometers of the, you know, those like really famous cycling cities.
I suppose that even in the kind of, say, 7 years, I'm wondering whether things have changed much in that time. And so you're in London, so maybe you aren't seeing it on the ground. But I mean, I suppose in my experience being in Belfast, the city still seems to be geared towards driving, you know, as the easiest option for people to get around. I'm going to try and make this a difficult question. So to play devil's advocate, if cars are moving towards, you know, fewer or zero emissions, does car use still remain, you know, a problem that can be tackled with moving to cycling?
Belfast in particular. So it is still one of the most congested cities in the UK. Like by all measures, it's properly congested with cars. Even if all of those cars were zero emissions, there's still a problem there. And that's kind of this underlying notion of, you know, this inactivity crisis that's happening in the UK at the minute, well, and elsewhere as well. And the fact of the matter is that because we're not taking kind of steps to introduce physical activity into our lifestyle, it's costing the NHS like millions of pounds. That in and of itself is a serious issue, even if you kind of segregate out environmental impacts and all the rest of it. So yeah, zero emissions, it's still taking up space. Like the amount of space dedicated to private cars in Belfast city centre, even back then when I was like looking at it and writing about, and that's actually what we also did a project, the parking day. Do you remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that was like my first interaction with Place, and that was off the back of some kind of work that I did, which is probably largely influenced by what Forum for Alternative Belfast were doing at that time. Mm-hmm. But I was able to kind of map out the surface level parking spaces in Belfast city centre, and kind of made this a really crude comparison to the amount of space we're providing for the private car compared to the amount of space we're providing for people in for the form of decent public, you know, public spaces. And Belfast, by far and away, it's almost like an American city in the way it's been designed, with huge roads, lots of surface level car parking, and that has an impact on, you know, actually the space we have available to build things that are useful, and also basically just trying to make things easier for people moving around in private cars. It isn't the best way forward whenever you look at different cities around Europe and the kind of trends towards each of them actually having to compete with one another to provide interesting places to live and work. And if we're kind of segmenting a whole lot of space in our city centre just to facilitate private cars rather than creating an interesting city, we'll kind of put ourselves on the back foot almost immediately, I think. Yeah.
Aaron, you've also pointed out to me how, I suppose, there's these kind of micro transit. I think that's what Americans maybe call it. Yeah. Things like scooters, electric scooters, you know, when you see people using them on the roads even occasionally now. I haven't actually noticed too many in Belfast, but when I was in Dublin recently for a visit, there were loads of these electric scooters, you know, booting around the place. So that kind of micro transit thing seems to have had a big impact on this whole how people get around cities. What kind of impact do you see it having in the next few years?
I think it is and it will continue to be really significant. Yeah, you haven't seen many in Belfast yet, but my guess is that they're coming. They're pretty ubiquitous in every city now, even without, you know, the legislation that supports them. They're everywhere. And I think it's a great thing. You know, from, you know, the groups of friends that I have, there's even like some chat this week about, oh, but they're using the bike lanes. They're kind of getting in my way kind of thing. And I think that's a really narrow view to have of it. And I think that it will be that kind of like argument, because you know cycling advocacy groups have fought so hard in order to get, you know, some space in the road, and now they're finding they're having to share it with, you know, e-scooters, e-bikes, you know, e-rollerblades or whatever it is next. I just made that one up, but it could happen. I don't know. Again, I kind of step back and look at the bigger picture of it, of, you know what, if it's someone on a scooter, it's one less person that's in a car. Someone who isn't, you know, clogging up the road, creating kind of congestion and emissions and all the rest of it. So I think it is going to be good for cities, and it's going to be really interesting to see actually whether it can sustain the boom that we're seeing, or whether it kind of dies back into, you know, in 5 years' time, do you remember that fad of e-scooters? What happened to them? But yeah, for now, it's super interesting to keep an eye on it.
So working in city contexts, I think you kind of sometimes need to go at different speeds, I suppose. Some things, you know, seem to change overnight and you kind of quickly forget what was there before. But other things might take a lifetime or longer to change. So what are some of the quick wins, do you think, that cycling in Belfast could achieve? And then what about some more longer term, slower pace changes that we might see?
Yeah, quick wins. And even in that blog series, I was talking about the work that in New York. And I know I always hate like quoting like big cities, because then it's like immediately it's not for us. but the approach like New York have taken to both public space and cycling infrastructure has been this idea of lighter, quicker, faster. So they test ideas like with really cheap, relatively cheap bits of infrastructure. Like, it's not much beyond, you know, providing a few cones down a street to test over a number of months or so. Would a cycle lane here actually help things? Mm-hmm. And being able to do that before you're committing, you know, millions of pounds of capital expenditure into a project, I think is a really good way to go about things. Even kind of quicker wins, you can see the likes of the work that's happening in Manchester. They're really leading the way in terms of UK cycling, mm-hmm. And planning for it. So they've got Chris Boardman's there. He's the now appointed the cycling and walking commissioner. He's got a pot of money. So I think he's had 160 million in his first year to dedicate to improving cycling and walking in the city. And the first thing that he did was go out to the different councils that form Greater Manchester and say, okay, I've got this money. Tell me where you want cycle lanes, where do you need cycling infrastructure, where do you need better crossings for people walking? And they compiled this plan, which then they digitized, put online, and left it open for public comment. Basically in this understanding that to deliver this, it can't be this kind of like top-down model of, okay, here's your cycle lane, enjoy it. It was more a case of, okay, so how could we help you? How could we facilitate better choices? if you want to cycle, how can we facilitate that better? So I think, you know, proper planning like that is a reasonably quick win. Mm-hmm. You know, making a plan, having a direction of travel, having a vision. And I'm sure that these things do exist in the Belfast context too. I just think, you know, the approach that Manchester are taking is probably one to watch.
You know, then, Aaron, you work for a company called C-Sense. Their kind of main sort of thing that they do is manufacturing bike lights specifically. I suppose we should note as well, this episode isn't sponsored and that other bike lights are available. You can obviously describe the company a bit better than I can, but they've also begun work in the field of smart cities. So can you tell us about that and what kind of things that you're working on for C-Sense?
Yeah, sure. So C-Sense is a cycling data and technology company. And yep, fair to say at this stage, it's best known for the kind of smart and connected bicycle lights that we make.
What is a smart and connected bicycle light?
Essentially, the bike light that we make has a number of different sensors within it, which basically monitor the cyclist's environment as they move around the town or city. And those sensors kind of pick up movements, for instance, that the cyclists make, and they respond to that by flashing brighter and faster when a cyclist may be more at risk. So, for instance, you know, coming up the junctions in the city or filtering in traffic, the bike light will detect that and basically give you a boost of visibility. As well as that, you know, it can pick up if a car headlight's approaching, and again, will flash brighter and faster just to, yeah, improve your visibility and let people know you're there. So that's good for you as a cyclist moving around. But that same technology also allows us to collect some really interesting data, which then we're able to work with cities and different partner organizations, basically to try and improve cycle infrastructure planning, which, yeah, is kind of essentially now my job, which is great.
So what does your kind of day-to-day work involve then?
We are a startup, so my day-to-day varies a lot, which is great for me. It keeps me busy. I am the program manager for the Smart Cities projects. So we're looking at data that is coming in from the bike lights that our customers share with us, as well as kind of looking at a few different projects that we're currently working on. So the main thing that's kind of taken up my time at the minute is a EU-funded project called Synchronicity. Mm-hmm. And through that, we've been able to deploy around 800 lights in three different cities. So Manchester, Dublin, and Antwerp. And what we've done there is basically team up with the city councils in each city and been able to distribute our lights. And now what we're doing is collecting data over the next few months. And we'll be going back to each of those councils and working with them to try and actually assess, looking at relatively basic things, you know, like creating heat maps of where cyclists are going to and from, as well as, you know, highlighting, we're seeing some instances of cyclists, you know, braking quite heavily at this certain location. What is that telling us? Is there an issue here? Even through the things which like is a real differentiator for us, but we can actually monitor the road surface in a city really quickly and in quite a lot of detail.
Through the sensors, basically?
Yeah, through the sensors. And compared to kind of traditional methods of collecting road surface data.
I didn't realize people collected road surface data.
No, you wouldn't. on the face of it, it is a very... it is quite a dry topic, but actually, whenever you think about it in the context of cycling, the proportion of cycling collisions that are attributed to poor road surface quality and potholes and all the rest of it is actually pretty significant.
So you're kind of getting down into this really like granular kind of level of detail.
Yeah. So it isn't just a case of, you know, the simple kind of GPS heat maps showing, you know, what route is popular, although those things are useful, but it's actually, you know, going beyond that into even greater kind of level of detail and greater level of insight for the city in order to help them make better informed decisions. So like the likes of the road surface stuff, as a local authority or as a council, you know, looking after the roads, it costs a lot of money for them to do that, and at the minute it's kind of they're either waiting for someone to, you know, report a defect in the road, or, you know, a pothole or something, and then they go along and fix it.
I have to admit that I've been nerdy enough to use the form that they have here for the Department for Infrastructure to report. I think it was like an overflowing drain or something. What an exciting experience that was.
You're in good company. I've done the same thing here. Twice on two different occasions I've reported potholes. So yeah, you're in good company. But yeah, and I'm sure, well, as I found it, like the actually trying to report those things, it wasn't the most straightforward.
It certainly wasn't.
No, it never is. And so one of the things that we're trying to do is actually be able to help local authorities prioritize where they're going, and say, okay, well, we know this street, and it's not just, you know, potholes that we're pointing at, because obviously cyclists avoid potholes as best they can, but we can actually tell, you know, where there is, you know, slight deformations in the road, which will inevitably lead on to potholes created or forming. So if we can alert local authorities to that before it becomes a bigger problem, it actually saves them quite a bit of cash.
I suppose the issue there as well is that those kind of slight deformations or like, you know, just, you know, subtle changes in surface texture, which you wouldn't notice, say, you know, if you're on a bus or in a private car or whatever, they're much more significant when you're cycling.
Yeah, exactly that. So yeah, so there's a lot of work just trying to, you know, better understand the needs of local authorities. And I guess that's probably one of the main reasons why I was kind of brought into CSense, was with that experience of working with both public and private sector clients over the last few years.
And what cities are kind of doing cycling data really well, do you think?
I think Manchester, again, I'd have to say, in terms of collecting data, you know, they have shown a real interest in it. London in particular, it's now got, I think, it's the world's largest database of cycling infrastructure. So they've actually gone out and quantified and mapped everything they have, from, you know, the advanced stop lines at traffic lights to all the different segregated lanes, the advisory lanes that they have. I think, yeah, they're really kind of starting to take a big interest in it and understanding the actual value of being able to quantify this stuff. And I think that's the big thing that we're trying to do. You know, when you look at the decisions or how decisions are made around transport planning and transport infrastructure. Overwhelmingly, cycling and walking, I guess, as well, are vastly underrepresented in terms of data collection. And it's the data that informs the models and the environmental or the economic appraisals that are made around transport planning. And for the most part, these models and economic appraisals, they use data from, you know, like the 2011 census, or they go out and they count cars, these old kind of patterns of travel and transport use. What we're trying to do is to say, okay, well, maybe a few years ago, you didn't have the information which actually backs up your argument about cycling, or backs up the hunch that you have about where cyclists are going to and from. But we can actually now provide that information and actually provide a resource that will actually help you create that step change and where you want to get to. So I think that's kind of like a really important thing to kind of consider in the terms of, you know, it isn't just data for data's sake. But it actually has a real value and benefit.
Probably some of the people listening to this will be kind of into all this stuff anyway. But who would you kind of recommend, or what kind of resources would you recommend people to kind of follow if they wanted to know more about cycling, either in the context of Belfast or in cities more generally?
Twitter is like still my go-to. I love Twitter. It's a really handy place just to keep on top of like new developments. So the likes of following this sounds quite dry, but the All Parliamentary Cycling Committee, APPCs, they have some really interesting kind of discussions and stuff that happen over in their Twitter page. Definitely be following, you know, Chris Boardman, Will Norman as well in London. And I think it's kind of following these people, Brian Deegan as well. He's kind of really, really big on design of infrastructure. Follow these names and then you'll get led to the kind of like the places and the resources in behind them.
And do you post publicly stuff about cycling as well on your own Twitter?
Intermittent retweets is probably how my Twitter best works.
I guess one last thing as well to ask you. So maybe if there's been people listening to this and they kind of feel like this all sounds really interesting, I'd like to see, you know, more cycling, but they feel just reticent about it, or they're nervous or whatever. I mean, how do you convince someone who hasn't cycled, especially in a place that they might feel is quite hostile to cycling? You know, how do you kind of encourage them to make that move?
It is difficult. You know, the perception of safety is undoubtedly it's the biggest blocker for cycling uptake. And, you know, we see that has an impact on particularly female cyclists or would-be female cyclists. Mm-hmm. I think it's that, you know, it's easy to say, oh, just give it a go. And you realize actually it isn't that intimidating, but like, you know, local authorities and councils in London now, for sure, they are running, you know, learn how to cycle courses for free, and aimed, you know, at adults, at people who are infrequent cyclists, or, you know, haven't been on a bike since they were 10 years old, just to make them more comfortable riding in traffic. Or, you know, what to do if, you know, there's a bus ahead of you, you know, just whip behind it, that kind of stuff. Yeah, so it is like, if you can seek out some organizations like that, I think that's really useful. Or if there isn't that kind of, you know, network in place, talking to friends or family who cycle as well and asking them, like, will you show me how to? Yeah. It can be as easy as that, yeah.
Well, listen, Aaron, thank you very, very much. I've really enjoyed this. It's been kind of a satisfyingly sort of nerdy hour.
Yep. Welcome to my life. Yeah.
So if people wanted to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Yeah, Twitter is probably the best place, to be honest. So yeah, it's at Aaron Coulter.
Thank you very much to Aaron for taking the time to chat with me. The Infinite City is produced by Place. This special summer season of episodes was made possible by an Arts and Heritage Project grant from Belfast City Council. Keep an ear out for more from the Infinite City this month. We'll be back soon.